Hello, welcome to Paradigm Shifters. This is Veronica Entwistle, and a lot of you are familiar with this show. But I want to say I have a very exciting guest today. His name is John Peterson, and he's a paradigm shifter as well, but he calls it the No Kidding Paradigm Shift, which I love. John Peterson, welcome to the show. And you are a futurist studying changes, why they happen, why they're accelerating. And you are also the founder of the Arlington Institute, which perhaps you'd like to explain people what goes on at the Arlington Institute. So welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Veronica. Well, I'm a futurist, and they're, you know, like lawyers, they're futurists and they're futurists, I guess.
You seem to cover so many facets of life.
Well, that's the difference. You know, that most futurists kind of specialize in some area or some sector, technology or politics or economics or whatever it turns out to be. And for reasons known only to, you know, somebody else somewhere, I'm interested in a little bit of everything. And so I look at the kind of writ large, where the world is going and where humanity is going, and in general and in particular with the emergence of a new human and the kind of the structure and possibilities of a new world. And there, I don't really know many other people who think in those kinds of terms, and I guess so that makes me unique in this kind of
space. Yeah, and I want to just interrupt you just for a moment, because you've had quite a history in the war experiences, Vietnam War. You know, we're of the same vintage, and a lot of people that I know went through that whole experience. And then you were in the College of War. What is it called? I've written it down here. National War College.
I went to the National War College and the Navy War College.
And lots of security studies, national security studies, right?
Yeah, worked in the White House at the National Security Council staff. And,
So that's a lot different than being a futurist, is it not? Because I would say that security...
Well, it is and it isn't. It is and it isn't, because my interest, frankly, and rather explicitly, was to, even though most of that was in the reserves, in the Naval Reserves, some of those things, but my interest professionally was to help to change the notion of national security from just killing people and breaking things, which is all they've kind of traditionally done, to this broader kind of perspective that took into consideration the fact that there was climate change, and there was social value shifts, and there was a technology explosion, and all of these things are just no kidding national security issues. And so during the Clinton administration, I was able to work with the most senior kind of leadership in the military to help introduce some of these kind of ideas through different kind of projects that we did and workshops and stuff with senior folks. And but then, you know, when little George Bush came in, then they wanted to go could do is kill people again. So I got out and started to think more broadly about the world and where the world was going, and ended up doing a wonderful project for the government of Singapore, where we did conceived of and kind of designed, developed, and executed a national surprise anticipation center, which was the first of its kind in the world, which was a capability that scan the horizon looking for the early indicators and the weak signals that would point to an inbound event of some significance that otherwise would eat their lunch if they didn't.
You mean like a volcano or like a tsunami?
Well, it could be that, but it could be things like if there was some kind of a stop to Singapore. You may know is an isolated little island, and they import almost everything. And at the time I was there, they were importing their electricity and their water and their food. And so if any of those things would stop, or if there was some kind of an emergent kind of issue relative to social stability, Singapore is very interesting in that they've got the Muslims and Christians and Chinese and Hindus and
real melting pot.
It's an extraordinary, and they figured out how to make it all work, and so it's the kind of the happiest place I've ever been.
Oh, really?
And it's the most economically developed place in certainly Asia. I mean, the quality of life there is amazing.
And I've heard that, actually.
The place isn't very big. After about a week, you've seen it all. But they are very, very sensitive to maintaining that. And so, you know, if that would start to change, or if there was some external threat or some sort, the way it got started was they had SARS, if you remember SARS.
I do, yeah.
The SARS problem. And their defense minister came to me and said, you know, John, we were looking at all of the other stuff, and we never saw the possibility of this SARS thing, and we never want to get surprised again. So can you build this capability for us? And so it's those kinds of things. You know, if somebody cut up the telephone cable that connects them to the rest of the world, there's just lots. It turns out there's, you know, maybe 1,000 or 1,500 different scenarios of significance that they would wanted to keep an eye on, and we built a database of those things and so on. But anyway, it was great fun and very interesting, and it got me quite familiar with the underlying technology of how you do sense making, because you've got to somehow start to automate the processes of these technologies to sweep the web and looking for certain kind of terms and phrases and so on. But anyway, that's what I've done.
Sense making, is that sort of partially intuitive as well, or is that getting vibrational shifts that tell you something's happening?
Well, in this, for you and me it is, but for them it isn't, because it's all technological.
Okay.
All of sense making, certainly in any kind of terms that we understand it, derives from pattern recognition.
Okay.
If you can't, when you look at anything, I'm sitting here in my rental car looking at trees, and it's a tree because I see a pattern that I recognize. And there's that old story about the Indians saw Columbus's or whoever it was, their ships coming, and they had no pattern, they had no way of recognizing what it was, and they didn't see it literally because it didn't make any sense to them. And so all of sense making and at its essence, the process of thinking about the future is all about trying to make sense out of incoming information and data and other kinds of
things. And also back to Magellan's ships, wasn't it once that somebody saw it and recognized it, then others were capable of seeing and recognizing it? Isn't that?
Yeah, obviously.
So
somebody's got to be out for somebody's got to be out in front, kind of trying to make some sense out of some of this kind of stuff, and then everybody else can kind of jump
on. Or maybe
on.
An intelligence is a shared thing instead. Also, I heard you speak, so this is jumping from Singapore, which is a really interesting thing, and I'd like to know more, but I want to get to the bigger picture where we know everything is changing. We know the vibrations have moved up. You spoke of moving through the galactic center. You spoke of some very great cosmic influences like sunspots and so on that were not only surprising Singapore, for example, but
yeah,
they're actually
everybody.
Shaking us all up individually and collectively, right? You want to talk a little bit about that and our political structure? You don't have to talk politics, but the political structure and everything is coming apart that we know, and I don't know whether the here.
Well, we're going. Yeah, there's a new world. There's a, you know, this is an end of one age and the emergence of another one. It's the big shift. That's what my friend Willis Harmon, when he was alive, wrote a book called "The Global Mind Shift." And there are, and it's more than just your mind. It is everything. This is an epical, extraordinary, unprecedented thing that this planet is going through. That's engendered by some of the things that you mentioned, the fact that we're moving into a new area of space that has a different energetic kind of signature, and so it doesn't provide as much kind of defense, if you will, against the great amount of energy that's coming out of the center of the galaxy. The influence that hits our sun and hits the planet and so on. At the same time, we're moving through the center of the galactic plane for the Milky Way. And the galactic plane is the organizing, is coincident with the organizing energy that keeps all of the stars in this, in this plane, like a platter. And so when you go through the middle of that thing, then that's the highest kind of energy. And so,
is it destabilizing the orbits of stars and suns and all that?
I don't think it per se destabilizes the orbit of stars. No, I think it just changes. Listen, everything's alive, okay? Let's start with that. And so when, just like you might think of it, is when we go from season to season, then when the weather changes, we do things differently. We need different kinds of stuff. And so in the same way, when you go into a different kind of context, or there's more sunshine or more rain or whatever it turns out to be from a cosmic point of view, the entities are affected differently. There are changes going on in our sun, for instance, that nobody has seen for about 150 years, and there's climate change going on every planet in the solar system. And the last time I checked, there weren't too many human beings on the other planets. And so what you'd have to come to the conclusion is that this was not, the climate change on our planet is not being driven by humans primarily, but it's being driven by the sun. And by the way, the sun's a lot more powerful, bigger than the human beings on this planet. And, at the same time, you've got the magnetosphere that protects us from all this energy coming out of the sun that is collapsing precipitously, exponentially collapsing, and so it's getting thinner. So more of this energy reaches us. There are changes on the sun, by order of magnitude, kind of differences on the sun between 1900 and the present time. And so it's a combination of a whole bunch of things.
But those are the kind of things
that coming together.
They could change the whole nature of, for example, humans or animals or trees, right?
Absolutely. Well, any recent reasonable kind of assessment of it all guarantees that it's going to do that, and that it's inbound in the next, 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, something like that. In any case, from my point of view or from my perspective, what it looks like that we're, 20 years out from the beginning of a whole new era that the Bible and all kinds of spiritual and ancient texts and channelers and on all say is the beginning of an era of no war. My friend Lee Carroll, who channels an entity called Cryon that some of your listeners might be familiar with, says that Cryon's saying that it could be as long as 15,000 years without any war.
Well, that would be wonderful.
Wow. Wouldn't it? But then if 15 years from now, the world does not see itself, the governments, whatever, do not see war as an option for solving problems and disagreements, what in the world has to happen between now and then in order to affect that amazing kind of change in perspective?
Well, let me ask you this. Sun stuff, isn't that impacting? I was listening to the part about DNA, or a part about DNA. Isn't that impacting our potential to be loving? It's probably a scary thing as well, because a lot of people are scared right now.
No, I don't know that it's scary. It's either scary or loving, depending upon your
point of view.
Point of view and your mindset. Yeah. And what multiple sources suggest is that there is going to the catalytic event that's going to kind of kick this off or solidify it or send it off in a new direction is some kind of a pulse out of the sun. Remember, the sun's intelligent, and it's and it gets to make these decisions about if it's the right time to do this. And there's almost certainly other kind of cosmological positioning and astrological kinds of stuff that are in play here. But there is, I think, kind of a point, a window in here where everything gets kind of all lined up, and then there's a, and I don't mean planetarily, I mean whatever the variables are, it kind of gets lined up, and then there's this energy pulse that comes out of the sun, and there are multiple sources that suggest that what it does, among other things, is it activates aspects of our DNA that have been dormant for thousands and thousands of years, and it engenders the emergence of all kinds of capabilities, things like ultimately things like telepathy and being able to see auras and being able to manifest things and maybe not even having to eat and any number of things that we already see different people, different places already doing. But what this seems to imply is that it becomes a generalized kind of orientation. And at that time, by the way, or the process of that kind of activation, if you will, it affects everything. It affects, you know, the dogs and the cats and the trees and the people. And in the case of the people, there are kind of in broad terms two different groups. And the Law of One people, well, from the Ra books from the Law of One, say there are those who are oriented in service to self, and others who are oriented in service to others. And that those two orientations essentially are, a filter or a gel or some kind of, it affects the way, it's really the other way around. You respond to this pulse of energy in different kind of ways because of your mindset and your orientation. And so those who are kind of selfishly oriented, service to self, would find this big change rather threatening. And, you know, they go get their guns and try to defend themselves or whatever they do. But at the same time, the other group that's in service to others would in whatever way, whether it's explicit or implicit, would be sensitive to and respond to this pulse of energy and would kind of rise to the occasion and surf it into this emergent new world. And it becomes kind of the, I mean, it's a science fiction sound and stuff. I fully admit.
I like
but
it.
But they rise to the occasion. They rise to become the kind of the seed population of this emergent new world that just goes off. And however that happens, whether it's multidimensionally or other.
Well, we've heard for a long time from people like Eckhart Tolle who said, I think it was he who said that there would be two Earths where, for example, if you are thinking and fear-based and security-based, et cetera, you would find each other. And otherwise, when you're in this other group, you would find each other and grow that reality.
Absolutely. And however it kind of appears to operate from our human point of view, the fact is that Eckhart Tolle and others all say, many others the Bible says that you're kind of in the world but not of the world. Well, so it's kind of like, it kind of looks kind of the same, but you don't kind of relate to it in the same way, and you certainly don't relate to all of the traditional things like governments and religions and other things the same way. I mean, it's a paradigm shift. It's the reorganization of the essential way in which we make sense out of reality. That's what a paradigm is. And if you have a shift in that paradigm, all the rules change.
That's absolutely fascinating. Hey, I wanted you to give people just that a little thumbnail about how the change factions, like something you used to take 1 million years, then 500,000, et cetera, et cetera. Can you tell them briefly about that collapse in that space?
Sure. I mean, if you,
those
if
are
you
paradigms,
go back
aren't
through
they?
History and try. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very much so. If you go back through history and look at the major kind of configuration, if you will, or the of the major kind of shifts that happened. And by the way, you can do this in I've got one slide that has 16 different domains. So it's chemical stuff, or it's you pick the domain of development from the beginning of time as human beings understand it, and they all go through this same kind of process. And early on, it was long billions of years of time where it was the same. The evolutionary biologists, for instance, say that it starts with single cellular life. And that was around for, they say 3.5 or something like that, billion years. And then there was some kind of a shift of one sort or another, and it became multiple cellular life. And the multiple cellular life then went on for 1/10 of the time that the single cellular life was around.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
So in rough terms, it'd be, 300 million years or something like that. And there 500 million years. And then it went from that to the early vertebrates. And they then showed up and lived for 1/10 or predominated on the planet for 1/10 of the previous time. And then you go through all of this. And you go to vertebrates and early humans and kind of hunter-gatherer kind of stuff going to active agriculture and then moving to cities and towns. And ultimately you end up with Gutenberg's movable type about 500 years ago. And in each case, generally, what you get is this acceleration. It's kind of like a big vortex, and it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And each succeeding era is more complex than the previous one by a factor of something like somewhere between 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 times. And so you get a more complex era, and the transition time gets shorter, and the length of the era gets shorter. And so what you've got is all of these things getting not only an explosion of information, if you will, but the movement toward that explosion is getting faster and faster. It's an exponential curve. Now, the interesting thing and the important thing about that relative to this conversation is that you cannot make sense out of the succeeding era from the perspective of the preceding
era. I think we need
era.
To hear that. Mm-hmm.
If you're a single cellular organism and you have this epiphanal dream in the middle of the night and you wake up saying, oh, there is going to be this big giant shift and it's coming, and you will run around and talk to all of your other single cellular friends and say, it's coming, what do you think it's going to be? Not a one of them is going to say, oh, it's going to be multicellular life, because everywhere they look, there is only single cellular life, and so there is no precedent for what is about.
Yeah, back to Magellan's ship, hey?
And you can walk. Yeah. Well, and you can walk through this everywhere. I mean, if you do movable type, I mean, the Catholic Church beforehand, but in the 1400s, they owned it all, and they were going all over the place, and they didn't see movable type coming up with just. It just ate them up in Northern Europe and stopped everything that they were doing all over the place and produced all kinds of problems that turned into what we've got now, because it changed the way human beings communicated ideas and moved ideas around, and the whole metabolism of the whole thing changed. Well, they wouldn't have had any way of knowing that beforehand. And so we're in a similar kind of position right now, where we're looking up this kind of mountainside going into some place that is just, if history is any precedent at all, which of course I think it is that this is going to be really amazing and really weird, because guys like Ray Kurzweil, who's perhaps the best known future guy running around right now, who specializes only in technology, he says there's 1,000 times more technological change in this century than the last century.
1,000 times more? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. In the last century, I mean, you started with the first cars, and you started with airplanes, and you worked all your way up to going to the moon, supposedly, and with and all kinds of space stuff and internet and all that. And then you multiply that time 1,000 times, and it's
incredible.
Just crazy. You can't even begin to get your hands.
But I've had this theory that I play with, which is the internet is training wheels for our intuition on a massive level. Do you think that could be true? Because when you say that 1,000 times, I immediately get a flash on the possibility that we move out of our body and have huge expanse of knowing and capacities that might not be on the planet. Now, is that too far out there?
Well, no. That's my talk that I gave a couple of weeks ago to the annual convention of the Unity Church.
Great.
And you're spot on. What's happening here is that there are so many moving parts and there's so many things going on that there's no way that you can logically make sense of it. If you're locked into your left brain and you're trying to build lists and say pros and cons and all
security,
that stuff, when you
and
make
security,
decisions.
Right?
Yeah, right. And first of all, you are making those judgments based upon the existing, by definition, old set of rules and things that are not going to work in the new space. But more than that, you just can't, you don't know everything. I mean, it's just so much stuff going on that there's no way in the world. Now, this is not an argument for ignorance and lack of education and all that stuff, because I think that you need to seed, I think you need to be informed, and I need you to seed your mind with things, because you start to see relationships and patterns between stuff like that. But as a principal mode of decision making going forward, logical linear kind of thinking is not adequate, not even close to being adequate. And so what there is essentially a balancing, right? Of the left brain and the right brain, of the feminine and the masculine, the feeling, the intuition, and what has to happen as you approach each one of these decision points in this world going forward, what you have to do is be able to access what it is to make an intelligent decision or an effective decision without having to essentially think about it. And that is intuition. And that is developing this, and what I mean is training. And when I say developing and refining capability to hear that little voice that's always there whenever there was anything you need to do that says turn left or turn right or give that guy a buck or whatever it turns out to be. And I can tell you, at least in my case, I can tell the difference between that and just my mind running around saying things. And I just do it. I don't care, you know, I just do it.
So what you're saying is when we're worried about all the changes and the lack of security and the old way of thinking and all that, you got to learn to let go into it. Is that right?
Absolutely, because you cannot, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, any ideas that you think about what's going to happen in the future, again, are only make sense in terms of what you've brought into the room, right? Your experiences and your other kind of stuff. And if the future is not anything like what you brought into the room, then all of the fear and all of the insecurity and all that stuff that plays around in common decision making is noise. It's counterproductive. And if you're going to live in this Eckhart Tolle kind of space of the now, then you cannot worry about the future, because worrying about the future generates fear, right?
And it shuts down your intuition quite often, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so it's really Star Wars like, you know, trust the Force, Luke. It's kind of like, you know, you just got to say, hey, this is going to be all right. And it is intelligent, and it is loving, and it is benign, and it's a whole lot smarter than I am. And just sit there and go with it. Go with it. And don't worry about it. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it anyway. I mean, worry is the stupidest thing in the world. It just accomplishes nothing. And by the way, it's a big magnet that then starts to bring all of the stuff you're worried about into your life, because you know, you attract all that.
Well, let me throw something at you. I think what you're saying and what I really actually get excited about is that the universes are making big changes, and all of that will fuel our ability to is fueling our ability to make the changes required to move into these new times. Is that right?
Well, of course, there's got to be internal consistency. There has to be some compatibility with the whole system. Otherwise, then it's really out of whack. And so what we're doing is essentially, in the same way that the Earth and the Sun, for that matter, and everything is working its way and trying to work toward higher levels of frequency and capability, or whatever it is for the Sun, I have no idea. But there's this universal kind of push for evolution, if you will. Evolution is kind of a human kind of thing, and so I don't kind of like the word in this context, but it's everybody's trying to, you know, be better and get, and where there are mismatch. I mean, this is the problem that we've got with a lot of weather problems and other kind of things on this planet, because there is human beings are closely coupled with the energies of the planet, with the Gaia and so on. And when we all are thinking about killing people and having wars and crazy stuff like that, well, there's any number of kind of indicators that suggest that all translates. It's inductive, you know. You and I were just at this science conference, and we're all these electrical engineers and everything. And so, and the concept here is that there's induction, that there is energy, there are signals, there is information that is induced from one side to the other of two elements that are kind of closely related to each other physically. And what that means is that, you know, the planet talks to us and we talk to the planet, and when we get bunches of people who are all trying to kill each other and stuff, then it really screws with the underlying stability and emergence and other kind of things of the planet.
And the pure kindness is there too, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and so you can make the case that, and it's compatible with some of the projections in terms of what the effect from the Earth, from the sun changes in the solar and the cosmic rays and such. But you can make the case that if we keep doing these wars and kind of things, it's going to turn into more, I don't know, volcanoes and earthquakes and other kind of earth changes. Now, it's not only us because the Earth is reconfiguring herself for higher levels of kind of emergence at the same time that we are. But if you've got a time of a long period of peace and there's not any kind of war, what's almost certainly a companion to that is you're not going to have wild and crazy weather problems. That it's going to be stable and for long periods of time because you don't have all of the stressful negative energy that humans develop around all of the stupid, crazy things that they do.
So you're thinking we have to go through a period of cold. Is that right?
I do. Yeah. First of all, what Cryon and any number of other sources say is it gets worse before it gets better. And how long it gets worse and how bad it gets, I don't know. But, it's probably not more than, 10 years.
But if war stuff influences weather patterns, surely peace will as well.
Yeah, that's my point. Exactly. Yeah. But there's a cleansing, there's a transition, you don't get changed without change. And so the thing has got to change. And what's happening here is the old world is imploding. Donald Trump is the disruptor, no matter what you think about him and as a person. And what he is doing is blowing up the system from the inside out. And that allows it to reconfigure itself. I mean, can you think of a nice person that would do what he does? I mean, we'd all like to have a nice president in there, but God, then you'd get more of the same. Because, by the way, the system is very impacted and very, very sophisticated, and they're not going to change unless somebody kind of sledgehammers their way into the middle of it, and that's what I think is happening. And so, but it's breaking it apart so that you can that makes space for the emergence of this new world. And so it's going to be really cool, I think.
I think it is too. I think it's pretty exciting. Let's go back into another. This is a change of subject from the whole political structure, but you've helped me with that. I think a lot of us can panic less, right? But one of the talks that you were giving was talking about the impact that we can have on our own DNA. And I've been thinking lately that healing seems to happen more easily amongst people using the mind and so on. It happens more quickly. I think there's a big tie in here. So what do you see for humans as we go through this transition?
Well, I ran a speaker series in my little town in West Virginia. We're about 100 miles from Washington, D.C. in the mountains of West Virginia called Berkeley Springs. And so every month I bring a different speaker of note from somewhere to, and we draw people from all over the East Coast. It's called Transition Talks, and you can find information on the web. Our next speaker is Bruce Lipton.
Oh, good.
And Dr. Bruce Lipton is the father of epigenetics. Epigenetics is this notion that your mind and your emotions directly change and affect your DNA and your cellular behavior and all other kind of things, and therefore your health, to say nothing about kind of the larger effect in your environment and so on. And so there is a huge, Joe Dispenza, all these guys, change your mind, change your world. 2 months ago, there was a scientific report that came out that was and new sciences or scientists or something like that. And what you've got is a bunch of, I don't know what you'd call them, cosmologists, whatever they are, who are now coming to the conclusion that this universe doesn't exist unless we think of
That's
it.
Wonderful.
That is to say, unless only when we think about it, when we open our eyes, whatever, we manifest. That's a kind of amazing that that's coming out of the middle of mainline science, but that's the whole idea that if you can change your mind, because all it is mind. Ernest Holmes, any number of folks, that's such, we are all one and all that business. It's all mind. It's hermetic Hermes, Trismegistus. It's all mind. Everything is just mind. And so if you can get to the point where you change your mind, you change your outlook, you change, all that just runs downstream and just affects and shapes everything. And so in theory, and there are people who are accomplished at this, but I think that this is kind of the essence of one of the major kind of emerging characteristics that are going to come out of this in a human. In theory, we can make it any way we want it.
Let's do it.
There's a guy named Robert Anton Wilson, who was an amazing brain young guy who, among other things, at the age of about 22, was writing the Playboy advisor for Playboy magazine back in the 60s when some of us were around. And Robert Anton Wilson did something that was really amazing. He took, if I remember right, 10 years or something like that. He said he spent 30 years trying to absolutely understand from any way possible how this reality worked. And so he went out and did drugs and did that stuff. And maybe it was only 5 years. I don't remember. But and then he did the occult kind of stuff and ran around with Aleister Crowley and stuff and in that space. And then there was another one, and maybe it was the kind of new agey kind of things. I forget what. But he just, and when you read about this, it's just mind-blowing. But he gets to the end, and he says, kind of, what's the bottom line? You can make reality anything you want it to be. And if that, he comes to that conclusion, and any number of other people, and, the Bible and whatever, then what you're into is this amazing kind of transition into a space where it all comes from the outside to the inside, right? Is that right now you look out here, and I'm looking at these trees, and they seem to be on the other side of the block, and it's all kind of outside. And if you ever, and I'm not there yet, I can assure you, but if you ever get to the place where it just becomes very real to you that you're just making all of this stuff up, then man, tell me where you can go with that. I mean, that could be really
awesome. Wow, I love that. Are your transition talks up online? Although I'd like to hear you talk as well. They're up online as well?
Yeah, we do. You can go to transitiontalks.org, and I do a little, there are the whole lineup. We've got Eben Alexander, who did,
he's a surgeon.
Proof of Heaven. Yeah, right, the neurosurgeon. He'll be there in November, and then or October, and Linda Moulton Howe will be with us in November, and I don't know, maybe I'll give a talk in December or something. I don't know. But it goes on, but
all these talks are really helpful, because people are reaching and having to open our minds to a much more, fluid, flexible, dynamic relationship with it all, right?
Absolutely. You're just breaking down the old kind of images and the old structures necessarily to allow for the emergence of a new kind of world, and a new world that is derived from the way you
Right.
think, right? So if you change the way you think, then you know, the whole world is going to change in front of you. I mean, it's just so interestingly kind of
It's wild and
crazy.
crazy. From Arcturian Chronicles, I've grabbed a line, I think ended with it, which is change the energy, change the reality. That's also really good. Yeah, I love that. But this has been such a wonderful experience for me to hear your perspectives and share some of your wisdom, or how about open to some of your wisdom, which is the opening thing I think we need to be doing, right?
Sure.
And I thank you. And you want to tell anybody about the Arlington Institute before we have to say goodbye?
Well, what we're in the business of trying to facilitate this transition to a new world.
Okay.
And very explicit and kind of, you know, I'm an engineer, so I want to build things. I want to do stuff. And I've got nothing against meditation and all of those kinds of things. You know, some of my best friends are in the leadership of all of that. But there's a new world that needs to get built here. And it's going to operate on different principles and different energy and different whatever, everything. And so we're in the business of trying to facilitate that in any way.
Does that mean like homes and buildings and systems of commerce or?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm in the middle of putting together and building a vertical farm. We've suggested, I think it's going to get cold. Going to get cold for a long period of time, and there is a really kind of clear cosmic kind of or solar and other kind of indications that say it's going to get cold, and that's going to influence food supply because of the way we grow food right now. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is build a vertical farm, an indoor farm that has glazing. It has glass over the roof of it so that we're going to do this into the side of a south-facing hill and surround it with earth so that you get the ambient temperature of the earth at 55 degrees. And so you've got, no matter how cold it is on the outside, you got 55 degree temperature kind of from the sides. And then you can get natural light coming in through the top, and you augment that with some LEDs and so on. And what you can do in this particular case is with a footprint of 2,000 feet, that's really just 2,000 feet, square feet, you can grow enough food for our whole county of 17,000 people. It's a minimum of 35 times more efficient than conventional agriculture, and in some cases, it's hundreds of times
more
efficient. And it's more efficient in both in terms of production and the economics are pretty interesting too. But if you can do that, then you get to get food security. And so that's what I want to do in the short term, because what it looks like, and we haven't talked about this too much, but it looks like that, and it's already started. It started about 10 years ago that the climate is starting to shift, and you're getting places that are colder than anybody's ever seen before. As well as hotter than any place. And what you're getting is the initial oscillations before you get a state change. If you have a complex system and a dynamic system, and it is and it's changing from one state to another, it doesn't just go from cold to hot. What happens is that you start to get this oscillation in the system, to where it gets hot. You know, some places are hot, some places are cold, some places are hotter, some places are colder, some places are really hot and really cold. And then boom, and then you get a rapid kind of shift in state. That's classic. That's how ice, that's how water changes, goes to ice, by the way, but converts to ice. And so what we're seeing right now are these, I mean, I'm on my way to LA, I'm sitting on my way to the airport right now. I was Orange County had 110 degrees temperature yesterday or so. So my friend who talked to his wife said, I mean, that is, you get these isolated places where it's really hot, but let me tell you something. In Siberia last winter, there was a place and they measured the temperature was 1 degree above the coldest it has ever been measured on the planet before. And there was in February of this year on two different occasions, there's 12 inches of snow in the Sahara Desert in Libya. There's the last summer, the ice didn't melt in places in Scotland in the summertime, and you had snow and in lower levels and places in Hawaii where you've never seen it before, and the press is not talking about that because they're all on this thing about anthropogenic global warming, but I'm telling you, there is, if you follow it and you're objective and honest about this thing, you can see that there's a very significant.
Well, so what about Antarctica and Arctic? I mean, that melting is pretty scary too, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's not melting all over the place. There are, what they found is.
You're saying do some research.
They don't tell you right. About this. They found volcanoes underneath the ice, which is melting ice. And it's not coming. Yeah. And they found now the guys that study this thing have they're at the place where they think that there are 2 million underwater submarine volcanoes under the oceans at different kind of places, and when these guys talk about the ice melting in Arctic, well, there's a whole string of volcanoes underneath the ocean up there that, and it's isolated stuff, and it's the same thing in places down in the Antarctic. There are just strings of volcanoes that are under the water that they found, and they are affecting the floating, the sea ice, and other kinds of stuff. Anyway, it's not as simple as.
Well, I'm really grateful you said that, because we've got some work to do. We've got things to look at. We've got some underwear, long underwear to buy. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, thank you, John Peterson. I hate to say goodbye, but I am excited for the work you're doing, and you've also prompted a lot of us to be thinking things through a little differently and letting our mind move with the wisdom coming through, I think.
Thank you
so much for your time. Arlington Institute, do they want to find you there, or do you want to give them at least one other website that might be nice?
ArlingtonInstitute.org. Or I have a newsletter, a free newsletter, which I publish twice a month, called Future Edition. That's called Future. It's a single E in the middle, FutureEdition, FutureEdition.org. And if they could, you can go there and sign up. And if you like this kind of stuff, we spread it out all over the web with emails twice a month, and we'd love to do that for your readers.
A lot of our podcast listeners are really active people in the world, so yeah, that's wonderful. I thank you so much for your time. I know you've been busy, and you were certainly an enticing and inspiring speaker at the Energy Conference at which we met.
Thank you.
Been
fun to be with you.
And you. Thanks very much. Bye.